Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 100 for April 16th, 2007.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to, like Michael said, show number 100. How are you, John?
Yeah. I was expecting a bit more fanfare.
Were you?
You know, marching band. Yeah. Or something.
Well, they were busy. I mean, they're always there every morning when you walk out to your car, right? So, here we are, show number 100. As promised, John and I, we weren't going to do anything special. We weren't thinking about doing anything special. But then we started getting comments from all of you folks asking us, what are we going to do? And one of you was wise enough to actually suggest something that really kind of struck a chord. And that is, as we've discussed, John and I have gone through and created the lists of all the computers that we've had. And the interesting thing is that John and I have known each other for over 20 years now. And so a lot of this we've kind of been through together. So it makes perfect sense to do this for the 100th show. So that's what we're going to do. There might be some normal content, but no guarantees. And we do have some giveaways. Originally we were going to do, we've got four things to give away, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Originally, we were going to do one for the intro, one for the outro, and then one each for two of your lists that John and I kind of went through and picked out of the group. I screwed it up. Everybody that I talked to seemed to think that the intro I was looking for was a remake of the song. No, really, it was what I just had Michael Johnston. That was Mr. Michael Johnston, the wonderful gentleman who goes through and turns this into an AAC show every week and enhances this podcast. So he did the intro for us. So he's being part of the team here, he's not really eligible for a prize. So there will actually be another opportunity for the second prize all the way through. And we might as well just talk about what those prizes are. The prizes come from one of our sponsors for this show, and that is from Smile on My Mac. This show, we're talking about Text Expander. And Text Expander is this great little thing. It's a system preference pane, John, and it sits and runs in all the time and monitors what you type. And what you do is you go in and you find things that you type a lot, like, say, your phone number or a signature or maybe even a graphic, right, a picture, and anything that you use regularly. And you create a text snippet in Text Expander and make a small little bit of text to associate with that. So, for example, let's say I want to have my phone number and I want to have my office number. So I just type 0603, the character 0603, and that's the code to Text Expander that tells it, yep, go ahead and type in my whole phone number. And or for my cell phone number, it's C603, and 603 is my area code. So that's, as soon as I type that, bam, the whole thing goes. What's cool is it's actually somewhat intelligent. In fact, it's very intelligent. You can have it do HTML snippets or any kind of programming snippets and have it place the cursor wherever you want. So if you type, let's say we do, if you just type href, H-R-E-F, boom, you can have it automatically build an href for you and an href tag in HTML and put the cursor in the middle. So that it, you can type whatever URL you want to put in your href tag. So that's Text Expander. They have all sorts of libraries available. There's one for HTML, and there's actually another one for all the auto corrections in that are normally found, like in Microsoft Office. You can import this library into Text Expander, and you've got it in every app, email, everything. $29.95. Of course, you can get a free demo online. SmileOnMyMac.com. So they have given us two copies of Text Expander to give away tonight and two copies of PDF Pen. And so we will be handing those out as we go through the show here. How's that sound, John?
Outstanding. Now, also, the show will explain to you a little bit of why Dave and I are the way that we are. We may be letting a few skeletons out of the closet here. So.
Or maybe we'll open the door and let the light shine in on the skeleton. I don't know that we're actually going to take the skeleton out of the closet, but the closet door, I think it's cracked open behind us here, John. So, All right, so let's get into this. And John and I figured we would do this chronologically, loosely chronologically. And being, you know, that which is great for me because since John's older, he gets to go first. I couldn't help myself.
Thank you. And actually, yeah, you know, a special day is coming up in about a week.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In fact, you get that day off. We're taking next Monday off.
Nice. April 23rd.
That's right.
The day. So anyways, you know, but I'm looking back on you know, what you and I did in our early geek days. I still remember, and I see you have, you know, some fond memories from your past here, but I remember as a young kid wanting a calculator, a digital calculator, and when I got one, it was really cool. Of course, then, like most things I got, I took it apart to try to figure out how it worked, and Dad couldn't fix it. So just even early on, I needed to figure out how things worked. Yeah. But anyway, so the first thing that I saw that approached a real computer was back in middle school when and I don't remember the exact model. It was a PDP something, I believe, and it had, you know, orange and yellow switches on the front, lights. But it had teletypes connected to it, and the coolest thing was you could play games on it. You could type in something, and it would respond to you. And I think one of the first games was, you know, Adventure, which I think almost everybody's played, especially, you know, like the Zork type of adventures. But then there were some other characteristics about that machine that made it, you know, less than optimal. One was that it was only printing on a teletype. Number two is that you had to load programs from a paper tape.
Okay.
We were seeing a paper tape reader.
You're dating yourself,
so
John.
We're not even talking discs here. one fun thing you could do is you could, if you figured out how to program the tape puncher, you could do little banners. But the bad news was if you walked across the room and you touched the main CPU, if you hit it with static, it would forget BASIC, and you couldn't write any more programs. Oh, no. And it took 45 minutes to load BASIC from paper tape. I still remember this, half an hour to 45 minutes.
Wow.
Then, you know, when I was in middle school was around the time where they introduced the Apple II.
Okay.
And this is where it just blew my mind because they're like, oh, check this computer out. And, here, let's show it to you.
And since people can easily look that up and you've chosen to date yourself, what year was the Apple II released? Was that late 70s, right? 77?
77.
Okay. Okay.
And the most amazing thing was, versus the other machine where you could zap it with static and you had to load something from paper tape, this machine, you turned it on and it had BASIC. That was when I realized this was going to be the best toy ever. So I was exposed to one of the first Apple IIs. You know, I had a tape cassette drive initially. There were some very early games. I think you remember like Lemonade Stand and all that.
Yeah.
And
oh, wow.
Some of us figured out how to write things. And I think we were talking 40 by 40, 16 color maybe. So really blocky stuff. But hey, it was better than the alternative, which was printing on a teletype.
Yeah.
So that was my initial exposure was the Apple II.
And what was – what? Okay. So I guess – from what I'm looking at from our timeline, we do have little cheat sheets here because there's no way we could actually remember this stuff on the fly. From what I'm looking at, I think I owned or my family owned a computer before you did. Is that right, John? Okay. So, I had a similar experience when I was in elementary school in fourth and fifth grade. The PET 2001 computer was popular, and I was the resident geek in school. But I, you know, didn't really have a whole lot of knowledge. Just had a burning desire to learn, and somehow my dad talked to the school administration and weaseled them into letting me take home this PET 2001 on the weekends. And it was maybe, you know, a couple weekends a month that we were able to do this, and I'd used it a little bit at school, but having it at home and being able to really dive into it, I was able to wrote all kinds of programs. My first big foray into programming was I charted it all out and wrote a program that I called Sans Hotel. And really all it did was play craps. It didn't play all the other games. The idea was to expand it out, but it never really got there. But we I sat down with a friend and we figured out, okay, here's the rules to craps and here's how this works and here's how the side bets are and all this stuff. And of course it was text, but I had dice that, you know, I mean, you kind of, you know, see numbers scroll by as they rolled the dice. So that was that. Obviously, and then started using some Apple IIs in summer camps and that sort of thing. But the first computer that we had at the house, we were at my, I'll never forget, we were at my dad's old college roommate's house one night, and he gave us a Timex Sinclair 1000. And I think this was 1982. It may have been early 83. But we were playing with it at his house, and then when it was time to leave, he's like, here, take it with you. And he had a TRS-80 and that sort of thing.
Otherwise known as a...
Trash 80.
Trash 80. That's sorry. Right. Yeah.
No, and so, you know, he had these things, and he had bought one of these Timex Sinclairs kind of on a lark and enjoyed it, but, you know, he didn't need it, and so he actually gave it to us, which was killer. So we had that thing. Now, programming that thing was a real trick because the keyboard was not at all touch typable.
A membrane keyboard, or was that another one of the Timex?
No.
So no real keys.
No real keys. It was membrane, but you had to push really hard. I mean, it was like hunt and peck, but you had to really peck. But it had a flight simulator program. It had the 16K memory module that stuck in the back, and you had to kind of make sure it stayed in there. Otherwise, if it fell out, things would like fall to pieces. But we'd load Flight Simulator, took, you know, maybe 20, 25 minutes to load from the cassette tape, from what I remember. And it was basically one frame a second on the screen that would, you know, maybe two frames a second, but certainly no more than that. And but you could take off with the plane and land it and fly it. And we actually had a lot of fun with it. And so there you go. And I'll let you take it from there, John. So we're in like 82, 83, and heading into 84. So,
and then 84. Now, prior to that, you know, 84 was when I escaped from high school. But before that, we had Apple IIs in the, you know, so from middle to high school, the Apple II, of course, was the dominant machine.
Okay.
Probably the only machine, and I was, you know, drawn to them and helped out in classes and stuff. I remember towards the end of high school was when they started offering programming courses, and most of us who already had computers at home, we just kind of, you know, skipped them because we could teach them. And I remember there were some hijinks going on in the lab, too, as far as, you know, some of the games back then.
Naturally.
And finally, around 84, I purchased my first Apple IIe. I still remember one of the things, Wizardry.
Yep.
Because I was into D&D like most good geeks back then, and Wizardry was just a realization of that, and it was over a summer vacation where it was like, you know, almost playing to the point of not being able to stay awake. one more level. I mean, you know how it...
I lived it, yeah.
But then shortly after that, and here is the peek into the look at the skeleton. Shortly after that, I heard about this thing called a modem and bulletin boards, and like, And a friend of mine, John, who we still talk to every now and then, guy I went to high school with, he's like, yeah, I know this guy can get you some software, and all you need is a phone line, and you can run this bulletin board. I'm like, wow, that sounds like something that's fun.
Yep.
You know, communicate with other people on the computer. And the modem I got was called, it was from Novation, I think you remember this, called Apple Cat. And this modem did things that no other modem could do.
Or should do.
Should is, you know, that's kind of making a value judgment.
That's true. Yes. We for what we're about to talk about, we reserve all judgment. That's right.
So anyways, we'll just cut to the, you know, the punchline there. So basically running a bulletin board, I got interested back then because, you know, we didn't have the internet and you needed ways to try to communicate with other people who had similar interests, and because we didn't have the internet, and the only way to do it was telephones. Fortunately, the Apple Cat had some software available that would let it do special things, like make calls that you normally cannot make.
That's right. You could use it.
It could
do all sorts of different colored boxes, including the fabled blue box. Whether or not you
blue
did
box.
That is, you know, I don't even remember.
Well, if I did, I'd be in good company because I do believe Steve and Steve
That's
were
right.
involved in the same sort of shenanigans.
That's right.
The Steves of Apple. Yeah. So anyways, full disclosure, it was the only time I got caught. But I was under 18, and basically it was the phone cops, and they said, hey, you know, you got good technique, kid, but cut it out.
Knock it off. That's right.
Stop making free calls. So, of course, now if we had, you know, because my only goal, I mean, it wasn't, you know, to make free calls. It was to communicate. And, of course, now with the internet, hey, and instant messaging. I mean, it's just amazing how the leaps and bounds where before you and I were both locked into pretty much people in the local area, unless you either had a lot of money for paying for long distance or you knew
other methods.
Questionable tactics.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Some of the things I remember about the Apple that was cool. So the modem itself was cool. The other couple of tidbits here that I thought were cool were getting the zip chip and it bumped it up to 8 megahertz from 1 megahertz.
Right.
We're talking megahertz, folks,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
So, man, when you took a machine that was already had a 6502 or 6502E, I forget, but it was a pretty slow. You could bump it up by 8 times. And then putting all those applied engineering cards in there because the machine didn't even have a clock.
Oh, yours so, didn't. That's right. Oh,
no, a lot of the early Apples, I think, and going over to you now, I think, but a lot of the early Apples didn't have a clock. They didn't know what time it is, and if you're running a bulletin board or doing a lot of things, knowing that is important. So Applied Engineering, I remember, was one of the better companies that made all these cards that you could stuff into your Apple II. So you had modem, parallel, serial, clock, music boards, I think, things like that.
Yep.
But then around the same time, you had, I guess, one of your first machines here.
I had always assumed that you'd had an Apple II earlier than I did, but looking at our histories here, you probably did, but only by a matter of months. Well, sure, you used them. Yeah, I just thought you had your machine longer. But anyway, in the summer of 84, after a grueling day of raking stones in our new garage that was being built, my dad turned to us as the family and said, okay, now it's time. We're going to go out and get an Apple IIc. And this blew us away because we had no idea that this was coming. And so we did. We went out and got an Apple IIc. Now, had he involved me in the decision, I would have pushed toward the IIe because, as John said, it was very expandable, whereas the IIc was more of a closed system and it was new and nobody really knew what was going to happen. But I was not going to let that day end without us having a computer in the house. So an Apple IIc it was. We got the...
It was portable. I would say one of the first... Transportable,
yes. Yeah, it had a handle on it. I mean, it didn't have a monitor. We bought it with the 9-inch green screen that was it was this metal stand that was kind of shaped like a U on its side. And one part went underneath the computer, and then the other part went, hooked onto the monitor. So the computer sort of tucked into the monitor. It was very ergonomic and very cool. It was the, 9-inch monochrome green screen. But it came with an RF modulator, so I don't think it was right away, but certainly within a couple of months, we were able to hook it up to our color television. Now, I had discs and discs of software at this point, as I'm sure you did when you got your computer, John, from friends and, where you'd been. So instantly was able to start... start using it. And then I think it wasn't right away. It might've been 6 or 8 months later that I really wanted to get a modem. And we had a friend of the family who, was running a bulletin board. So I knew what he was doing. He was into the IBM side of things, but he was a good guy anyway. And he was the one that it legitimized this whole idea of connecting it to the phone line. Cause otherwise I think my parents might have, and my dad, he's an electrical engineer. So he was sort of into it, but sort of not. So we kept buying these modems, these Hayes compatible modems, and hooking them up with a serial cable. Cause you couldn't buy an AppleCat for the IIc. There was no slot to put it in. And we were having all these problems. We couldn't get it to work. The lights would go weird. And then finally, I remember the guy's name was Mike Schlegel. We were at, I can't remember the name of the computer store. It might have been an Egghead. It was down in Norwalk. But I don't know, some computer repair shop. And we had him check the IIc. And he's like, oh, well, there's a new logic board upgrade. But really, your problem is that you need this PopCom modem. So I got this PopCom 1200 baud modem. And we plugged it in, and it just worked. And that was it, sold. So that was my first thing. I think it was 1985, and got the modem and then started connecting to all these bulletin boards around. And when I started connecting to all these bulletin boards in the local area, I kept hearing about this bulletin board that was up, but was on hiatus, and no one was really sure when it was coming back. And the bulletin board was called Treasure Vault 2. And then one night I was on this local, it was called DiversaDial. It was this system that ran on an Apple II where you could put 7 AppleCats in it and have 7 people, 8 people, including the sysop, right? Or 6 AppleCats, and the 7th was the sysop chatting. Mm-hmm. And I ran into the sysop of this other bulletin board, Treasure Vault 2, that I knew was an Apple II-based board. And his name was, can I tell him what the name was, John?
No.
Okay. Really? I'm going to tell him anyway. His name was The Shadow, and of course, The Shadow is as you all know him, Mr. John Braun,
and he knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men.
Mm-hmm. So
that was the inspiration.
I think shortly thereafter, you did finally restart Treasure Vault 2, and I think that was 19. Well, it would have to have been 1986. Because I remember you, the first time we spoke on the phone was in 1986, and you called me to voice validate me as a new user on Treasure Vault 2. Now, you got to understand, this was Treasure Vault 2 was a big deal. John was like a local rock star in the bulletin board community.
Because my phone exchange. Now, remember back then.
That's why. Oh,
my. Well, it wasn't just my phone exchange. It was also because I was, you know.
Connected.
Me.
Very nicely put.
But no, for some reason, I lived in an area, and it was called Georgetown. And it was not so much a town as like a
district. This is Georgetown, Connecticut,
They put a... So there is no town government. It's a district or a region.
Right.
But they had a phone exchange, and I was fortunate. And it would reach places that in no way, shape, or form touched where I live.
Right.
So I had an immediate advantage because, again, you... really couldn't, you know, most people that got modems weren't into running up massive, huge phone bills, which now when you think about that, it's like a thing of the past. I mean, long distance, huh?
Yeah.
Who does that anymore? That is like so... but yeah, because I was in an area where so many people could call in, I mean, it was ringing off the hook, and I only had one line.
Right.
So that was a lot of fun. But I also, as Dave pointed out, I like to keep, run a tight ship.
Mm-hmm.
So I would voice validate people so they wouldn't goof around. So people were accountable for what they did on the system. So if they called and signed up for something, I called back just to make sure they were who they said they were,
yep.
which was not an uncommon practice back then.
Really nervous that night. I remember,
ooh,
you know, when the phone
shadows.
When the phone rang and, my dad says, Dave, it's for you. Hello? You know, I'm just a kid and John got on the phone and, you know, he had his big deep voice. He's like, hey, it's The Shadow. And I remember, it's a good thing I remember asking you how old you were. I don't know why I asked you that at that point in time, but I did. And that's what allowed me to remember what year it was. I won't tell them how old you were in 1986. If you want to. Just keep that. Leave that as an exercise to the listener.
But I remember that because they had some boards where anybody could sign up.
Right.
And
right.
Those boards tended to degrade into...
kitty wars.
Yeah, flame wars. Or early flame wars were started on these systems.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, because I knew everybody, and a lot of us got together through... like the the multi-user chat systems. The other one you and I were talking about that Steve ran.
Yeah, the suspect ran. You know what? Let me tell him about the other sponsor for the show here, and then we can tell him about this because this is actually a great little tangent. I realize this whole show is tangents, but you know, you knew what you were signing up for. We're here. So the other sponsor for tonight's show is Audible, and Audible is. For those of you who don't know, a reseller of audiobooks, and they've got, you know, like over 35,000 titles online. And if you click through our special link that they've given us, it's in the show notes, you get one free download. Now, this is a cool thing. These books are awesome. Lisa, my wife, the other night just signed up and she downloaded Salem's Lot, totally unabridged. And she was playing. It sounds great. It'll sync up with her iPod and, you know, you can play it on your computer, on your iPod, you can burn it to CD. Basically anywhere that you could play this podcast, you could play an audiobook from Audible, your Trio, obviously it'll work on a PC as well. And they've got all kinds of stuff. They make it really, really easy to do all this stuff. How I Invented the Personal Computer from of course Steve Wozniak is in there. That's in there unabridged. Stephen Levy's The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. Alan Deutschman's The Second Coming of Steve Jobs. That's in there too. All kinds of great stuff. So Audible, available at audible.com. But if you go to MacGeekGab.com and click through on the Show 100 show notes. You'll see the link for the your one free download. Check it out. It comes with a 2-week free trial, and very, very cool. So, all right, as promised, we had this buddy, and John, you knew him better than I, or got to know him better than I did, although I guess we all kind of, we all wound up hanging out. And he had, I think it was a PDP-6, isn't that right, that he got from his old employer?
It was a machine that they were going to toss, I guess.
Okay.
I don't know if you consider it a super mini or a mini, but it was probably what you could, probably what, you know, you could fit on a desk and buy for $500 now. But still,
that's
it
right.
was a deck, a version of deck. I mean, I remember it had these big disc platters.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't talking floppies here. We were talking things that were like, you know, the size of a bicycle tire.
Right. And so he set it up in his basement, and he got, what, 8 phone lines and wrote from scratch in, is it RPG? Is that what he wrote it in?
I think he did BASIC.
No, I thought it was BASIC. RPG. I don't think it was BASIC. I'm pretty sure.
He had some stuff in BASIC.
Okay. Well,
so I remember we were goofing around, but he probably patched together a few things.
Yeah.
I think he had a few different compilers.
Okay. So, yeah. So he wrote this bulletin board, and it had, bulletin board, which is essentially like forums. For those of you, and I realize now all of a sudden there may be a ton of
What's
you out there.
Board?
Right. Yeah, they're saying this. That's right. So the idea behind a bulletin board was a single user, right, typically. A single user, the ones that John and I, and we'll talk about mine in a minute, the ones that John and I ran were single user at a time. You would log in, you could check your email from other members of that board, and we won't get into the whole FidoNet thing, but essentially it was that board. And then you could go to the message bases, and each one, you know, you might have, I don't know, 5 message bases or 50, and each one had a different topic, you know, general, just like the forums that you get at, you know, MacObserver.com right now. But the difference was, of course, you were the only one interacting with it at any point in time. So you'd log in and do your thing and read new messages and post something and then log out. And maybe somebody else would log in and post something new. And then you come back and you check new messages. So Steve had all that, and he wrote a chat system. And it was really, really smooth the way this guy, the interface and everything, it was all text. But he hooked up these, you know, 8 modems to it, and you could get online and chat, and it worked out great. Right, John?
And I remember some spirited evenings where we would, you know, like to play tricks on people, especially people who we didn't necessarily like. So
that's right.
I may have accidentally turned a modem off.
Yeah.
I believe Steve did this. So we did something to discourage people. We wanted to go away. He wrote a program that would inject what looked like line noise into the serial data stream.
For just that
one
person.
Because modems, you know, I mean, voice telephone lines were never intended to send or receive data. Modems are just kind of a hack. I mean, they're dealing with a bandwidth that was meant to reproduce human voice, not data.
Right.
But of course, you know, throughout, you know, both our careers, Dave, I mean, we started with 300 bit per second modems.
You did. And I started with a 1200.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I had the AppleCat, which was 300 and a little.
And a little, 1200. And 1200 half duplex. That's right. Yeah.
But if the phone line was not up to snuff, sometimes you may have seen a little tilde or a little, you know, weird character. So what we do, he wrote a program that would inject this at increasing, you know, frequency into someone's data stream until they figured that there was something wrong and they hung up. Of course, then the next person calling in would get their line.
Right.
It was first come, first serve.
Yeah.
But that was fun. And then a lot of us got together, and I still remember is that people never, ever look like how they sound.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. We would do it at Cranberry Park in Norwalk, Connecticut.
Yes.
We would do
Big Tree and all that. That
yep,
was great.
We what started as Comlink, that was the name of this multi-user bulletin board that Steve wrote, and we would do these Comlink gatherings where people just get together on a Sunday afternoon and bring a Frisbee and burgers and beer or what, you know, whatever, and just hang out. It was just a, you know, time to get together with face to face with all these people that, you know, that otherwise you just knew by handle. The cool thing was, like John said, most of the time all these people were local, so you didn't have to travel to a trade show or whatever to meet all the people that you were communicating with. They were usually right there. So
we also had,
go ahead.
If you recall, this was still CB era.
Right.
So to complement, so the tools we had at our disposal to meet other people were the modem, which was, you know, a relatively small population, but then several of the people that did modem also did radio, either ham radio or CB or something else. So those were the tools we had at our disposal. I mean, this is way before you know, affordable cell phones.
Oh, yeah.
I think they had the bricks.
Maybe. I don't know.
Nope.
Yeah.
All right. Dating ourselves here.
Yeah. So then also in 1980s, and really, you know, when I was going through this today, I realized that, you know, my formative years were spent on that Apple IIc. I mean, there's no question about it. My formative computing years, and frankly, my formative years for what I was doing, because it was that or I was down in the basement playing my drums. But in 1986, I upgraded from the 1200 baud Popcom to a 2400 baud US Robotics Courier, the USR Courier 2400. And this was like the holy grail at the time. It was a killer modem. It had error correction. It had all this great stuff. And, of course, it could transfer files at twice the speed of the 1200 baud modem. But remember, I couldn't plug in all these Hayes-compatible modems into my Apple IIc. But I'd learned a lot since then, and I knew there was a way to make it work. And so the 2C had a DB9 serial connector on the back of it, and so did this Popcom modem that I had. It had like this weird thing. It was just built for the Apple IIc. But I'd done some research. Now, remember, there was no Google, there was no internet. So, you know, it was just piecing together bits and pieces of data that I was able to scrounge around. And I thought, okay, you know what? I think the serial port on my Apple IIc is backwards. And what I did was I built a custom RS-232 cable. So it was DB9, 9-pin serial port on the Apple IIc, 25-pin port on this US Robotics modem that was coming in. And I realized that I needed to, it effectively was acting like a null modem. So I had to swap pins 2 and 3 for send and receive data, 4 and 5, which I believe were clear to send and ready to send or something like that. And then pins 20 and 6, which were
DTR and DSR was one of
DTR
them.
DTR and DSR, that's it. Thank you.
20 was at CT, but yeah, there's
yeah. And so I had to swap those three pairs of pins, and then everything worked. I was able to get it all working. The computer could flow control, right? Because if the data stream coming in was too fast for the computer to process, it had to tell the modem, no, wait, hang on. And the modem had a little buffer. And so all of that worked. It was all hardware flow control, which was great because that then got me ready for the next phase, which was setting up a bulletin board. Now, I kept calling all these bulletin boards. Did you have something to say before I got into this one, John?
Where could we be here?
Okay. I think not really.
Serial cable. I just shudder at the serial cables because I remember there was an age where getting the hardware to work was half the fun, or figuring out the cable.
Yeah.
I remember doing it for serial printers and just getting machines to talk to each other. And I think those were probably the bad old days. Whereas now, I mean, you don't even think about it. You plug something in,
it just works.
The problem now, I think, is a lot of the work is now
drivers
put in the lap of the software writer, not the hardware wiring type of guy.
Right.
But yeah, go on.
Okay, so I got this bulletin board, or I got this courier, and then I guess it was late 87, maybe early 88, that I realized, okay, look, I'm going off to college in about another year and a half. Wouldn't it be cool if I set up a bulletin board here? I knew I was going to get another computer for college, and so wouldn't it be cool if I set up a bulletin board here where I could exchange email with my parents, because the computer, you know, the Apple IIc was in the house. And I wanted to set up a bulletin board anyway, so this was kind of the excuse. And so I went. I had also added what was called the Apple UniDisk to the Apple IIc. Now the IIc had a single-sided 5 1/4-inch floppy drive built into it, and I think I'd added a second one of those just so I had two if I wanted to copy disks. But I'd also added a 3 1/2-inch Apple UniDisk, which was an 800K floppy, 3 1/2-inch floppy. Double-sided, not high density, double density. I don't think it was high density. No, the Mac was the first thing that I had that did high density. And so I figured, okay, well, I got enough room on one 800K disk. I can run a bulletin board. And I did. I got a copy of GBBS Pro, which is also the thing that John used to run Treasure Vault 2. And I was a big fan of the Douglas Adams Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy trilogy, which isn't, but and so I named the bulletin board Milliways, and it had a nice theme to it, and you know, pulled all this stuff together. One of the things I didn't like about GBBS, and I know there's like three of you out there that remember this, three of the, whatever it is, 25,000 that listen. And GBBS, when you logged in, you know, you would get a command prompt, and there were single key commands that you would type, you know, B to go to the bulletin boards, M, or I think E to go to email. I can't even remember now. I don't think they called it email. I think it was just M for mail. But whatever it was, there were different things that you could do. And I always hated having to hit return. I really liked the bulletin boards that I logged into that did one key, and it just went. You know, when you type a key and bam, off it goes. So I actually wrote a one key input routine for that. And now for your bulletin board, which also ran GBBS Pro, you wrote an index, because once you got enough users on the system, it would really slow down logging in, right? Somebody would type their password and it would take forever to look them up. Yeah.
And yeah, so I got to learn a bit about how to modify software, because when I looked at the code, what he was doing, was it Greg Schaefer?
Greg Schaefer, that's exactly right,
Man, it's coming from the past. But anyways, and I looked at his routine, and because I had probably, you know, I mean, I think I had at one point like 300 users, which now it sounds, but for a local bulletin board, that wasn't shabby. And the problem was, what he would do is read through the user file a user at a time. So you would type in your username and password, it would read through each record,
right,
saying, is this it? Nope. Is this it? Nope. Is this it? Nope. Now, you know, that's kind of inefficient.
Yeah. So then Especially if you were user number 255.
Yeah. If you were the last schmuck that just signed up for an account, it would take you the longest.
Right.
Which wasn't nice either, because I would see people that would hang up because it would take forever. So I'm like, well, let me write a little, you know, you set an index routine, you know, and I think what I did is, you know, check the first letter of the last name. So I think I created an individual, you know, I mean, primitive when I look at it now, but I think I created an individual file for each letter of the alphabet. So it's like, oh, you're a B. Okay, I'll go to the B file.
Right. Right.
Or something like that, or by user number. So I would, you know, break it down so it wasn't always looking from beginning to end. And everybody was like, oh my gosh, what did you do?
Yeah, that's right.
And so, your bulletin board is so fast, I don't have to wait a minute to log in. Yeah. And then I shared that with you, and you and I both shared. Like, I think I like the single key thing. So,
that's right.
And everybody in the community was always sharing, you know, tips with each other.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And that single key thing was cool, because the routine I had to write was actually monitoring the data stream, right? Because normally GBBS would just sit there and wait until it got an enter, and then it would process whatever the text on that line was. It wasn't watching the input stream, but it had the capability to, because as the sysop, the system operator, sitting at the keyboard, I could, you know, hit, I think, control C to chat with the user, or control A to put the user on hold and go into the administrative thing to do something I needed to do, or whatever it was. So I knew that it was monitoring. It had the capability to be aware of what key was being typed at any moment, and just found where that hook was, and then just, you know, hung this little subroutine off of it that essentially would go through a loop saying, is the character one of these, you know, 18 things? And if no, go back to the top, and which was, is the character one of these 18 things? And it would just sit there and go round and round and round. It was very inefficient from a CPU utilization standpoint, but the computer was a single task machine, so it didn't matter if the CPU was running at 0 or 100. It was only doing that one thing at that point. So I don't even know how taxing it was, to be honest with you, because it didn't matter. It was fast enough so that if you hit B, bam, it would. And the cool thing was, I didn't just have it jump there. I had it fill out. If you'd hit B, it would just say bulletin boards, or M for message boards, or whatever it was. It would type the whole thing out and then bring you to whatever the next thing was. And it had to load each module from the floppy. So if you logged into a bulletin board and you hit B to go to the bulletin boards, you actually had to wait for it to load them from the disk. Thinking about that, and then thinking about what and the TMO code base, to be fair, has been modified and enhanced by a lot of people, but the core of the TMO code base I wrote. And so to think about how fast that runs with, you know, thousands of people on, you know, each hour or whatever it is, it blows my mind, to be honest with you.
We cut our teeth on the BBS days.
We did.
I think I did that until about late 80s, and then also I kept my trusty Apple IIe, and I actually did it for both my associates and my bachelors, because back then Apple IIs were usable in school. I remember most of my work either in BASIC, or some people may remember the mini assembler, and 6502 was a very nice assembler to learn because it was small. And you had an accumulator, two registers. There wasn't a lot there, but it was almost like a RISC processor. But I also remember UCSD Pascal. You may have done that.
Yep.
And Pascal was kind of the thing you did in school.
Yeah, Pascal was great. Pascal reminds me a lot of PHP, you know, John. I know you don't do anything in PHP, but it's sort of the same thing. It's very simple. So.
Yeah, but the 2E served me both pretty much through about 4 years of college.
Okay.
Both for Pascal, BASIC, also did, you know, some Honeywell and IBM 360 work. And then when CPM came out, I took a Z80 course, and of course they had a Z80 card for the Apple IIe, so I was able to use it for that. So it was cool that it was a machine that could be used for college work.
Okay.
Because it had all the things, because they're like, oh, you're on an, you know, because then, of course, you know, you had the IBM people, oh, well, you can't do real work on an Apple.
Right.
It's an educational machine. I'm like, well, it runs UCSD Pascal. They're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. So now,
so
which
there's always a bias, which some of us had to live with having an Apple.
Oh,
Apple was classified as the educational machine for, like, school kids, not for, you know, college work, which... But of course, you know, we know there were lots of, you know, Apples in labs and, you know, colleges and stuff. But it started even back then, the persecution.
The persecution. So which one, you went from your 2E to your first Mac, and I went from my 2C to my first Mac. Which one of us got a Mac first? I think I did, right?
I used...
You
Mac
used
2s
them first
when I did a co-op.
Yeah, I remember the first Mac.
I purchased my first in '90. You, I think, got your. Yes, you were the first. You got a year before me.
Yeah. So the first Mac I ever used, though, I remember was at your house because you were bringing home like a Mac SE maybe or something.
From one of your co-op gigs.
Yeah, that was the first time I used a Mac.
I don't know how I scammed them. I'm like, oh, I need to bring this home.
Right, that's right.
I'm like, really? Okay. And I'm like, oh my gosh, they let me take a Macintosh home.
Yeah, and you called me up, and of course I ran up to your house, and that was that. You know, John and I, we would get together about once a week. There's something familiar here. And it was at night, usually on the weekend, and we would, you know, get pizza or something. And we would just geek out from, you know, maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 o'clock until I had to go home, which was, you know, about midnight, I guess. And this was actually even before I was driving, right? You would come down to Norwalk and pick me up, and we'd go up to your house and then bring me back. But, I guess that it's not too much different from what we're doing now. Anyway, in 1989, I was getting ready to go off to school. And so I got a Mac SE 30, and I got it with the 40 meg hard drive and 1 meg of DRAM. This is megabytes, not gigabytes. And then I remember I got a deal so it had 8 memory slots in it, and it came with 4 256K chips. And I found a deal, or, you know, somehow got a line on 4 1 meg chips. And so I thought, oh, I can upgrade this thing to 5 megs of RAM. I'll never forget the afternoon I did this. I was on the floor of my room. It was, you know, summertime. It was hot. Sweat was pouring off of me. You know, I'd gotten one of the big long-handled Torx T15 screwdrivers that you needed to open up the SE30. But the first time you opened one of these things up, man, you had to really kind of pry that case apart.
Well, I had a case cracker, right?
I didn't have the case cracker. I had to make a notch in it with a screwdriver.
Because I don't think Steve really wanted people to get inside.
No,
of
but
those.
The cool thing was, once you got inside, like the all-in-one Macs before it, it had all the signatures inside the case, and so,
so I, the Apple actually my 2E I think did also.
You're right. It did.
The Apple IIs did too.
Yeah.
More of that.
No, and the
style
Amigas
anymore.
Did too, didn't they? The Amigas or I think it was the Amigas had signatures in the case. So I finally did it, and that was my first real foray into operating inside a computer, because of course, remember, I had the 2C, which I'd opened up and put some chips in, but I shouldn't have. So that was my first Mac, which I did then take to college with me, and then I got caught. But anyway, what was your first Mac, John?
So my first Mac. During my undergrad work, I also did co-op, which I recommend for anybody. Internship, co-op, work in the field before you commit yourself to a life of potential misery.
Wow. Way to sell it, John.
I mean, as you know, no, I'm just saying, you know, give it a trial run before you get a degree in something and spend your life at it.
For those of you that are on your way to work and used to this 45-minute podcast thing, now's the time when you're getting to work. There'll probably be another 15 minutes for you to enjoy on your way home, because we're not going to stop here. We've got plenty to go through, so keep on trucking, John.
Okay. So anyways, at one of my co-op gigs there was when I was exposed to the Mac 2, which, oh my gosh, compared to your machine. I mean, the SE was definitely cool, or the SE30, but the Mac 2 had slots.
Right.
Lots of slots, because I work for a boss. I mean, we use them for data entry, but we use them for so much more. So it was just a very forward-looking boss who got us these, because there was always stuff to do, and we didn't have to do it data entry. But then I finally, when the CI came out, because the one thing I didn't like about the Mac 2 is you had to buy a video board.
Right.
Didn't have onboard video.
Right.
The CI was one of the first, I think it was the first Mac 2 that had onboard video. I think the I was integrated. And I think it was a 68030. So I was like, oh. That's the one for me.
Okay.
And that was nice. That had the signature in the case, but it had slots.
Right.
And so that was a very nice, that was my first Mac.
That was
around
machine.
1990.
Yeah.
Yeah. The CI, but it got a lot of people excited because they integrated it. You could certainly still get video, but you had it on board in case.
Right. Just to start with. That's right.
Yeah, so it was a good starter machine, and I think it brought more people into the Mac fold because you got everything you needed in one box.
Right.
And yeah, back then I remember putting 1 or 2 meg chips in there.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, I finally
wasn't a lot.
Bumped my SE30 up to 8 megs of RAM, which is the most you could do in that. And I eventually put a card. I think it was a SuperMac or a Rasterops card that would allow me to plug in an external and color monitor. So that bought a lot of life out of that thing for me. It wasn't until 1995. That I had moved down to Austin in April of 1995, and shortly thereafter ordered the first clone available, which was the Power 100, mm-hmm. and got one of the first 100 off the line. Mine was the only one of the first 100 that had any problems, or, you know, so they told me. And being that they were also in Austin, I actually wound up bringing it up there and met Mike Rosenfeld, who was their marketing guy and has kind of bounced around since then. And that was the first place I met Bob Levitis, because he was their chief evangelist. And he doesn't remember.
Really?
Introducing me to him. Yeah. And it was a very brief thing. It was, you know, Bob was like walking by, going somewhere while we were working on my machine. And he's like, oh, this is Bob. And I'm like, hey, you know, and then what was that? But yeah. And I had that for, you had one of those too, right? You had a Power 100, didn't you?
I did. Yeah, I had two of them. I look back, so I had a Power 100 because I think you inspired me.
Right.
And the clones were all the rage because I think some people, and I think the power computing went a little, you know, you had a little more oomph to the machines. I think they, you know, deviated. If I recall, I mean, it must have been something that caused us to buy it.
Well,
it was cheaper.
The price.
That's right.
It was ridiculously cheap, dude. You know, it was like, it was the same, effectively, the same computer as a Power Mac 8100/100, but, I mean, it was, like two-thirds the price. It was, there was no question. It was like, yeah, and that's the machine. And it came with a t-shirt.
And you know,
did you get that the t-shirt with the license to clone or whatever it was on the back? It looked like a driver's license.
Yeah, I don't know if I still have. Yeah, I remember that. And they had they had events at some of the shows. Did they have a bungee jumping thing?
They did. Yeah,
they were crazy.
That was Mike Rosenfeld.
But, you know,
he was crazy.
But you know, I have to agree with the shutting down of that, even though it was unpopular. Is that?
Oh no, it was better for Apple. Yeah.
The brand would have gone away. So.
Oh yeah.
Sorry, the machines weren't going to be as cheap as copper PCs,
now,
but they have their upside.
In 1995, when we bought our Power 100s, I also, now I had moved to Austin, and I had done, relatively speaking, fairly well financially before we moved down there. I was consultant. I'd weaseled a great little gig at Citibank, and effectively had moved down to Austin with about a year's worth of living expenses in the bank, which wasn't bad for, you know, early 20s or whatever. Lisa and I just kind of picked up. We were dating then. Our first shot at living together was down in Austin. So we went down there and knew that we had to get jobs at some point, and we started looking. And while we were looking, I remember one night we went out to dinner, and while we were waiting for a table, Lisa was reading the local Austin, you know, scene rag, and it said that there was this band from Boston that needed a drummer for an upcoming tour in the fall. And I don't mean to get real sappy here, with tears in her eyes, she hands me the thing. She's like, you have to do this. And sure enough, I did. It was a band called Hypnotic Clambake. They're still touring around, but I spent 3 months on the road with them playing drums. And before I left, this does tie into the Mac stuff, I knew I needed a way to keep connected while on the road. So I bought a PowerBook 520C, which I believe had a 25 megahertz processor in it, the 040 processor, if I'm not mistaken. And I also bought an acoustic coupler because I knew that I was going to need to get online in weird places. And believe it or not, I used it from payphones to get email. And that was pretty cool. It was like War Games. You know, I had this, it was a, you know, it's strapped into the phone and Velcro straps around. I've still got the thing somewhere in one of my, you know, boxes of history here. But I used that on the road. So that was the next purchase. And I had that laptop for a long time. That was my travel machine, as slow as it was, with a passive matrix screen.
Mm-hmm. Hey, it was a start.
Uh-huh, absolutely.
Now, you know, looking back, actually, I didn't mention this, but I think you stopped by this place. But from around 84 to 87, I worked at this place called Small Computer Service Center, Westport. They're not there anymore, but that was... it was just, you know, around the Apple II days. They sold software, hardware... And so there was a wife who was a teacher, and then the husband, and he was an engineer, and he actually inspired me during my studies, because he taught me how to fix things at component level, like how to do things like solder and desolder, and back when they had chips and sockets, and you could debug things.
Right.
It was a lot of fun.
Cool. All right, so which one of us bought...
Anyways, to move forward again, so where...
I think in 1997 was when we both bought our next machines, right? I bought a PowerCenter 150. I sold my Power 100 to a client whose SE30 I scorched while swapping RAM. You had to be really careful inside those SE30s not to break the little video tube, and I broke hers. So I sold her my Power 100 cheap and bought a PowerCenter 150, and... And I think you bought something more manly at that point.
PowerCenter Pro 210.
Such began the wars that John and I have had over the years of who had more muscle, who had more computing muscle at any given time. And John at that point stretched out way ahead of me.
It's a guy's thing.
That's right. You know, oh, absolutely.
My lawnmower is bigger than yours.
That's all it is.
Snowplow. Well, whatever. You know, it's a guy thing. You just...
That's right.
Lisa knows this, right?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. She understands. Yeah. So it gets a little boring here, right? Because it's... I mean, that, now we're just getting into computers that we use.
Yeah. But we got... We shared an appreciation for the... Pismo, I think
we did.
Call it.
We both got Pismos, and you didn't buy yours. And I'm looking at your list here. I actually found the email today, and that was in 1990. It was in 2000 that we both got our Pismos. Mm. So, yeah.
But the thing I liked about that Mac, number one, it was kind of curvy. It was kind of an interesting design. It was square, but it had some curves, so it just caught your eye. But
it was sexy.
The thing I remember is it had two bays. So if you wanted to, and you wanted the thing to weigh 10 pounds, you could put in two batteries, and you had, like, infinite battery life.
Right.
That's the one thing I miss from all the current batch of Macs is that they... And that, I think, was a piece of excellent engineering, is that both sides, from what I recall, you could put compatible devices in either side, except maybe the CD-ROM drive. But
yeah, the CD-ROM only went in one side, but you could put a zip drive in and all kinds of other stuff. That's right. Yeah.
And the zip actually leads to, I think, one of the machines I got down the road again.
Okay.
A lot of this now is just newer machines. But I remember probably the worst choice I made, and I'm looking at this machine right now, glaring at it, actually, was a G4 with, here we go, here's the 1-2 punch of dead drives, a DVD RAM, and a zip drive.
Yeah. The zip drive worked great for a while, though.
Neither one of which, and I think, yeah, zip drives, if I recall, the big deal was I think they were 100 megabytes on a, right?
Yeah.
About that.
Yeah.
On a floppy size, about a floppy size thing. So that was just blew everybody away.
Yeah.
Now, of course, what do we got?
Yeah.
DVD something or other.
All right, so I'm gonna let's unless there's anything
fast forward.
Yeah, let, yeah so I'm gonna fast. I'm gonna fast forward to where I am, and then you just fast forward to where you are.
Yes.
So in 2000, I bought the PowerBook Pismo, to which I added a 19-inch SGI display at one point, and that was really my switch to where my laptop. Since 2000, a laptop has been my main machine. There were some moments in there where I rued that, where I almost went back. Then upgraded to a 1 gigahertz G4 PowerBook, a 1.25 gigahertz G4 PowerBook, finally a 1.67 gigahertz G4 PowerBook that I sat on for over 2 years and couldn't stand it anymore. I can stand so much, but I can't stand no more. And finally ordered walked out of the keynote speech last year. And you folks know this story. The longtime listeners do. Walked out of the keynote speech last year in January of 06, sat down in the speaker's lounge and ordered my MacBook Pro. That's my main machine today. The other Mac that I use, I bought used actually on eBay, is a the one that I'm using right now. The mirrored door dual G4, dual 1.42 gigahertz G4. And that's where it went. The PowerBook's all
nice.
The way around. Very nice. But I did just find one thing. August 24th, 1994, I have the first email that I sent over a TCP/IP connection. John and I had shell accounts with various providers. I think one was called Portal. But but we were able to use this thing called Slip. It was PPP is what we would connect with, but there was this thing that allowed you
serial link internet protocol.
No, it was called TIA. There was this thing, it was this piece of software called TIA that you ran on your shell account on a Unix machine that allowed you to connect, and TIA stood for the internet adapter, and allowed you to connect your computer directly and use a direct TCP connection, which is exactly what we all use now when you connect broadband, or even if you connect dial-up, you're still using PPP. And so the first email that I sent once I got that working was to John, vazrat@your email address.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And it says, I think I'm going to like this TCP/IP thing. I just need to get PPP working because Slip tends to suck. Oh, well. And Dave, so that was the first email that I sent from my Mac SE30 using Eudora, and I've still got it in my archives along with everything else I've sent since.
Uh-huh.
So
I'm yucking it up over this. Well, actually, no. The first one I sent to you, good news. This was sent on November 21st, 1996. Yeah, I guess that's
funny. You had it before that, I think.
Yeah, I think I may have some past Eudoras. This is when I switched over to another provider, and I'm like, ooh, they're only $17.95 a month.
Yeah, it was cheap, yeah.
Well, it was, but not for the speed you get.
No.
I mean, for the 300 or 1200 or 24,
it was 24
whatever we got.
Yeah.
And actually, I guess we maxed out at 56, but even then it
eventually
was kind of 56. But now I'm looking at, I got a T1 at least.
Way more than a T1. Way more.
Or yeah. Fiber, actually. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so do your fast forward. So in 2000, you had your Pismo, and then?
Yeah, so Pismo, and then pretty much it progressed to PowerMac G4 with the aforementioned drives that no longer have support.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got what they called a TIBook, Titanium PowerBook.
Right.
That was around 2001.
Yep.
Then PowerBook G4, which I still have. That was about 2004, maybe.
Yeah.
And then 2005, I got the PowerMac G5, dual 2 gig. So I'm still Intel-less.
That's right.
Probably not for long.
Oh, really? Is there something you want to tell me, John?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm waiting for a 12-inch Intel machine.
Well, that might come. I mean, who knows?
I may be waiting for a while, but
you
I just
may.
Like
yeah.
the form factor.
Right.
It's my favorite travel machine, and I see so many people that have the same machine, and it's just...
Yep.
Not that your machine, you know, that's...
Oh, I like it. Although, you know, I was talking to Greg Snyder at Backbeat today, and he was in the market. He actually placed his order today, but he was in the market for a MacBook Pro, and I said, you know, if I had to do it again, I might do the... just the MacBook. I like the smaller size, to be honest. So,
and the keyboard's not bad.
It's killer. It's awesome.
I was nervous because I'm like, oh, it looks like a Chiclet keyboard, which we ran into in our early days, and those were terrible.
Right. Yes, terrible.
All right. So we got through. I think we got through the history here.
Okay. So that's our history. There's one cool thing that we found, but before we mention that, we'd said that two of the histories would win the licenses for one will win Text Expander and one will win PDF Pen, and so here we go. The first one, you want to do art first or mic first, John? You pick. I guess we should do art first. Yeah, okay. So art wins PDF Pen. And Art's computer history, we got so much of this stuff, and I want to thank you all for sending it in. John and I both
read, it was a trip down.
Was awesome. It was awesome.
Reading how far back some people went, especially.
Yeah. Yeah. Scott Barman had a
good bunch of geeks.
We do. Scott Barman had a comment at the end that is the exact same thing I am to John when I finished putting my history together, which was, man, that was fun. And it was. This was awesome. So anyway, Art struck our fancy because he had, the first computer was an Apple II 16K serial number 660, which he still has in the original box.
Three-digit.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. He was there.
Here's the next thing. He had an Apple Disc II, which went with the Apple II, serial number 450, purchased when it came out 6 months after buying the Apple II. He upgraded the Apple II to a 2+.
Here he gets major geek points here.
By swapping out the integer basic ROMs with floating point basic ROMs. That's serious geekery.
If you know what he's talking about, the first Apple IIs had an early version of basic. So this guy pulled the chips out and put them back in.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was talking, at one point in time, you could take chips out and put them back in. It was amazing.
Yeah, computers were hobby machines. I mean,
not just memory chips.
Yeah, right. You're right. Yeah, chips that mattered. So then he had a Mac 128K, which he purchased in a bundle with the ImageWriter 2 and the external disk drive, upgraded the Mac 128K to a Mac Plus, then an original PowerBook, i.e. luggable, 100 with the lead acid battery, an Apple Newton message pad. You know what? I had one of those.
I have one.
Yeah. Yeah, I sold mine when I bought my PowerBook 520C. A Mac 2SI, a Power Mac 7200, a Power Mac Cube 500 with the 15-inch studio display. And he bought it as a refurb when they were discontinued and is still using it. So maybe not. Oops. An iBook 700 megahertz with three logic board repairs that were fixed under warranty, which then turned into a 900 megahertz iBook, which was the free bonus upgrade, kind of like what you got, John. But he says that, too, had two logic board failures. So maybe there's something going on. And now he's got a white Intel MacBook, first generation Core Duo, which he's still using. And he says in the planning stages are an Infrant Ready NAS and a Mac Mini. So there you go. That's Art with his very low serial numbers on very early Apple machines. So that's Art. Now, Mike's story it's a good story, so it touched us, and independently, John and I both picked that as when we sat down tonight to say, okay, which ones are we going to do? That was the one. So Mike gets a copy of Text Expander from smileonmymac.com, and I'm going to grab some water here while John entertains you with song, and then I'm going to read this. You know, I should have taken Scott Barman's advice and played Girl from Ipanema there, but I didn't. If I'd had it queued up,
A Monty Python type intermission. Right. I thought I did.
Mike writes, I love the show and I've never missed an episode since I've switched. I've been a PC user for over 20 years. I worked for a major computer manufacturer for 18 and ran my own small business computer consulting for a couple years after that. I've owned PCs since their conception. and even a few microprocessors before that. And an example being the Motorola D5 I used to control a follow-behind electric golf cart. I've owned every IBM PC from the first up to laptops. I started buying Dells after starting my consulting business. I've been through all the operating systems from PC DOS, MS DOS, every version of Windows, and Linux. I used and supported all the Windows versions as part of my consulting business and was considered an expert. My son was deployed to Iraq and came home on leave and decided to buy a PowerBook G4. I went with him to the Apple store in Albany, New York, and advised him on all the extras he should get. He said he would only get all that stuff if I promised to help set everything up. When we got home, I was prepared to spend a few hours setting up the PowerBook, as was usual the case with all the PCs I'd had. I was shocked and stunned to find out that there wasn't much of anything for me to do. Everything just worked. That was my first step in the Mac conversion. My son took the PowerBook back to Iraq with him for the rest of that tour and took it with him on a second tour. It's been dropped, kicked, and pulled off tables, tripping over the power cord, and never failed, ever. He has since been stationed in Germany and came home for last Christmas and presented me with a PowerBook as a present. I've used nothing else since. It is not what it once was cosmetically, dented case, scratches, etc., but it has not failed me yet either, and I wouldn't give it up for the latest and greatest available PC on the market. I'll be purchasing a 17-inch MacBook Pro Core 2 Duo in the near future, but I've been holding off until the rumor mills have it. It supports Blu-ray. I thought this little story might be interesting for your 100th show. Again, I love the show. Mike, thank you very much. It's just a great little story. So there's a copy of Text Expander. I'm going to ask the folks to email me here. I know I've got your email addresses, but if you hear it in the show, email me and I'll put you in touch with the right people and get you the licenses. So before we head to our outro, and I got to get everything queued up because you know how I am here. This has been a little disorganized. Mm-hmm. We've been at this for a while tonight. There was one cool thing we mentioned, DiversaDial, right? That piece of software, John, that ran on the Apple II, 2E. Man. And you plug in all the modems, and you plug in, I guess, 6 modems, right? Or you could do 7 if you ran it headless, right? If you didn't have a video card in it. There is a DiversaDial live available via Telnet, but the cool thing is it's actually running on an Apple II with all these modems in it. There are 7 modems that you Telnet into that automatically then dial. But they're real modems. In fact, if you hang up from the bulletin board and issue AT commands to them, well, there's a way of figuring out that, yes, in fact, they're courier HSTs that are dialing into these old Apple cats. And it's all available at diversadial.com, D-I-V-I-E-R. Just go to the show notes, diversadial.com. And you can Telnet into wherever it is at port 6001 and actually chat with other people. So John and I will do that at some point. And I think that's enough. We do have 2 outros because we have 2 prizes to give away. Nobody did the intro, and it's because I didn't explain it right. If anyone ever wants to do the intro for a show, just the like tonight, the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 100, whatever it is. If you ever want to do one, send one in. If it fits the vibe, we're happy to consider that. So
and I got to say, just go for me. Yeah. A heartfelt thank you. I mean, this is amazing. 100. If it wasn't for people calling in, writing in, and all that, I don't know if we'd still be doing this. I don't know if I would.
No, we wouldn't. Absolutely, we wouldn't be. I mean,
so
we'd
it's
still...
awesome. I mean, it's like a little family here. I mean, the Frapper map amazes me, and just all the emails and all that. And I don't always respond, but I read and listen to as much as I can.
Yeah.
So.
No, it's great. I mean, John and I would still do this. I mean, we've been doing, I don't know that we'd do the podcast, but we'd still get together. But it's you folks that make the podcast possible, enjoyable. I look forward to this. I look forward to working on Monday nights. So there you go.
The histories, again, just really, it was so cool to just, see everybody's background, how they got into the.
We may read some of them.
How did they find us?
We may read some of them on the air at some point in the future.
They're good stories.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, there's some great stories in there. All right. Portable Media Expo, September 28th to September 30th of this year. I think John and I will probably be there again.
Yeah.
Next week, we've got a... next week we're not here. I'm in Florida. So 2 weeks from tonight, Monday the...
I get a week off?
You do.
Sweet.
Yeah, I think Monday the 30th, right? For your birthday. Happy birthday to John from everybody.
I get my birthday off?
I think so. Yeah. That's right. Anyway, Yeah, so, and then we'll be back in 2 weeks with answers to your questions. Cashfly Hosting's where you've downloaded this from. Podcast Marketplace has the A5 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo from Barebone Software, BB Edit also from Barebone Software, one free download from Audible, but you got to click the special link, and PDF Pen and Text Expander from Smile on my Mac. And, you know, I guess that's it. Thank you again. Like John said it great.
We're gonna let them say it for us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a little something extra at the end here, as promised. And these were fun to go through, too. Thank you. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Dave.
Hey, girls, what does Daddy always tell you?
Don't get caught!
Very good.
Made up.
Thanks to Michael Johnston, too.